Okay, so we had 236, serve your spiritual mentors and listen respectfully, aid them and attend to them. Always respectfully honor other bodhisattvas as well. So respect your own spiritual mentors, and then even people who are not your spiritual mentors, but you know, you can see are very good practitioners, then also show respect to them. Okay. And here's an interesting verse, 237. You should not pay such respect, honor, or homage to others who are non-Buddhists. Through that misplaced respect, the unknowing become attached to faulty teachers. So he's saying to the king here that, king, you know, you have high status in society, and people look to you for what to do, and they'll follow your examples. So if you follow non-Buddhist teachers, or even Buddhist teachers that are very controversial, and if you show them respect, then the people who follow your example in your kingdom will do so also. And in that way, they will be misled and will follow faulty teachers. Okay, understanding what he's saying? So this is quite interesting. The Buddha said, you know, because when he was alive, many people followed other teachers and then started following the Buddha. And he would tell them, you know, you don't have to stop making offerings to your other teachers or to the other wanderers, he said, not necessarily teachers, but to the people who practice other traditions, because I think he wanted to keep peace there and not have the benefactors all of a sudden, you know, help him and neglect everybody else, because that would create a lot of friction in the community of renunciates. But here, Nagarjuna is saying, especially regarding teachers, not just practitioners of other traditions, but faulty teachers, that if you show respect to them, then other people will think that they're good teachers and follow them, and they could be misled. So in the West, now we find the situation where Buddhism is new. People do not know what qualities to look for in spiritual mentors. And so anybody who calls themselves a spiritual mentor or a teacher, people think, well, they must be, you know, and they must have completed a certain education, they must have been screened, they must have been authorized, and that is not the case at all. Yeah, and so it's very much our responsibility as students to check out the qualities of people before we become their disciples or their students. So we can attend their teachings, you know, listen to what they say, see if it accords with the general Buddhist perspective, look at their ethical conduct, look at the quality of their other students, if their other students are well behaved or if they're all a bit weird, you know, see if the teacher has a good relationship with His Holiness the Dalai Lama or not, and so check things out before we actually make that connection. Yeah, so it's really incumbent on us to do that. Because there's no certifying board or anything like that. And so His Holiness often comments that there's people who in the Tibetan community are kind of not realized as anybody special, and they come to the West, and then either they give themselves a bunch of titles or their students give them a bunch of titles, and then they, you know, sit on a high throne and wear a lot of brocade, and then everybody goes, wow, you know, and especially if the teacher has some charisma, then people are drawn, yeah. And if you, you know, really study the qualities of a qualified spiritual mentor. Charisma is not one of the qualities to look for. Okay? But charisma is what attracts naive people in the West because we don't know anything about Buddhism. Okay? So it's important to go slowly and really check things out. It's like you wouldn't marry somebody right after you meet them. Well, I mean, sometimes people do, but it's not so smart. Yeah. You get to know the person, don't you? You check out their qualities. You see them in different situations. You see if, you know, kind of things work well between you. So it's the same way with spiritual mentors. You don't just, you know, go to one teaching and then, oh, that person's spectacular. You know, you have to be thoughtful about the whole process. Okay, now he's going to talk a little bit about the collection of wisdom. So here, again, are specific things we can do to collect wisdom. So offer manuscripts and volumes of the word of the King of Sages, in other words, the Buddha's teachings, and the treatises that come from it that are written by the great Indian and Tibetan sages, along with their prerequisites, pens and ink. Yeah? So if you're going to offer texts in ancient India, you need to have the leaves, because everything was written on parchment or on leaves, and you need to have pens and inks. The ink, now you need, you know, a printing press and so on. But it's very nice when you go to Asia, there's this custom of people making offerings in order to publish Dharma books for free distribution. And it's very, very nice because then people create so much merit by giving the Dharma in this way. It's exactly this thing of collecting wisdom by sharing the Dharma. And people who are interested can get small booklets for free, you know, so that makes them more receptive to picking it up. So that's actually how I started writing books, because I was living in Singapore and one man came to me and he said, if you ever want to do a book, let me know. I'd like to contribute. And then as I was giving talks there, I noticed that people were asking the same questions again and again. So then I said, okay, let's make a little book of Q&A. So we made a little volume like this and people sponsored it and it went out. And it was very popular, but only in Singapore, and a little bit in Malaysia, a little bit in Indonesia, because the books nobody knows about them. So when I came back to the West, then I went to regular publishers, simply because of the ease of distribution, because they advertise, and then that way people can find out about the books. Yeah, but then people have to buy them. And it's actually much nicer when people don't have to buy them, when people create merit by giving them. But our culture is such that, you know, you don't know about the books that are there unless there's a publisher involved. So, what to do? But they still do that in Singapore, and it's really quite nice. I appreciate that a lot. Okay, 239. For the sake of increasing wisdom, provide for the livelihood of the schoolmasters in all the educational institutions of the land and formally grant estates to them. So here he's talking about public education for the kids. Yeah? Pay your teachers, support your teachers. Make sure that the schools have enough money to give education to the young people. Yeah. Now, I don't know how it is in Denmark, but in my country, the Republicans just want to slash taxes And as a result, the teachers are not paid very well. And in one state, they even had to reduce the school week from 5 days to 4 days. And the students were using textbooks that were all worn out and 25 years old. And so just a couple of weeks ago in Kentucky, West Virginia, and Oklahoma, three states, the teachers went on strike. You know?
Same here.
And I said, good for them, because I was a teacher before. And, you know, teaching kids is not easy. And especially if you don't have good materials to use to teach the kids. Yeah? And so we, here he's saying to the king, support the schools. But this is going for us to really support education for kids, especially underprivileged kids. You know, kids who may not have pre-kindergarten things or who lack materials and toys and so on. So help them to learn, or be, like in the States we have this thing like a big brother or a big sister. So for kids who, you know, maybe their family structure is kind of falling apart, so, you know, there's somebody who acts as an adult to help the child or to tutor the children. And it's so important, because all you need with kids is one adult that believes in them. That's all a kid needs, is just one adult who believes in them and encourages them. And they'll fly. But some kids don't have any adults that do that. And instead, all they hear at home is criticism, or the parents aren't there, or the parents are involved with drugs, or the parents are workaholics and work 12 hours a day and come home exhausted and make a lot of money, but then they have to use the money to pay for their kids to go to therapy because the kids don't feel loved. Yeah? So really reach out to kids. It's so important, because they're the ones who are the future, and we need to take care of them. I'm so happy in the States now that you probably know that after the Parkland shooting, now the kids are protesting. Yeah. So just actually 2 days ago, they had another walkout in the schools. It was the 19th anniversary of the Columbine school shooting. And again, the kids walked out. And I'm going, right on, you know? Because that's the way to get the attention of the lawmakers. Because our lawmakers, you know, are just, yeah, they're just interested in their own status, their own money, and they're not, you know, actually representing the people who elect them. And so, as democracies, we need to follow democratic principles and say something. Yeah. I can't help but talk about politics. People, you know, wondering, I came to a Buddhist talk, what's she talking about, American politics? Well, I don't know anything about Denmark politics, so I'm not going to comment on them. But, you know, but I do know about American politics. And in my mind, Dharma is so much a system of values and a way of life that it's got to apply to everything. Yeah. It's not like, you know, Sunday morning you go to church and do whatever, and then the rest of the week you really do whatever, you know. But whatever your values are in your spiritual practice, we should apply these to all the facets of our life. And not have compartmentalized lives. Yeah. Where, yes, equality is good for all the people I like. But all the people who are different from me, equality doesn't apply. No, that's not the way to practice the Dharma. Yeah, we have to be consistent. Okay, now he's really getting into the king, you know. He's saying, with the proceeds from your fields, establish wages for doctors and barbers. I think barbers means dentists. You know, because in ancient India, you got your teeth yanked, you know, out on the street, probably by the barber. Okay. So with the proceeds from your fields, establish wages for doctors and barbers for the sake of the elder, the young, and the ill, so as to relieve the suffering of sentient beings. Okay? So have health care for all of your citizens. That's what he's saying. And he's telling the king, you pay for it. Yeah, because the king has the money in the treasurer. Yeah. So you make sure that the kids have a good education. You make sure there are doctors and dentists. Yeah. So the elderly, the young, and the ill can receive the medical care they need. So we live in a different kind of society. You can't ask your queen to do that. Yeah. But we should, you know, as a society, really encourage the government to make sure that everybody has access to health care and that nobody's left out, yeah, because they're poor or they're homeless or whatever. Okay, that's very important, I think. I mean, how can you say I'm going to work to benefit all sentient beings and then be opposed to universal health care? Yeah? The two things don't fit together. 241. You of good wisdom established rest houses and build parks and causeways, pools, pavilions, and cisterns. Provide for bedding, grasses, and wood. So here he's talking about two things. One is beautiful places where your residents can go with their families, and there's pools and parks. And we walked back to where we're staying yesterday from here, and I think you guys have beautiful parks. Yeah? Man, we walked through two parks getting there, you know? So I think you're doing a good job with that one. Yeah? Because we went out there, so many families are there with their kids and playing ball and walking the children and teaching the babies how to walk and wheeling the elderly, and it's beautiful, you know, so that people can go outside and interact and have a social life and meet other people. So that's very important. And then also for travelers, okay? So, you know, in ancient times, then again he was saying to the king, because the king held the wealth, make sure your infrastructure is good. Make sure you have good roads, yeah? And then have rest places on your roads. And since they didn't have running water, you have cisterns. And since they didn't have microwaves, then you have to have wood for the travelers to make their, cook their food on. You know, they didn't have fast food there. Yeah. Yeah. Gee, McDonald's really missed it, you know. They could have made a lot of money back then. Okay. But he's telling the king, you know, make it easy for travelers. They should have water, have, you know, places for them to sleep. Our version of hotels and motels, have food for them. Make sure that travelers are comfortable and that they're safe. Yeah. So again, good social advice, isn't it? You know, so what I find very interesting here, and there's many verses that go on about this, is the king is, Nagarjuna is really dictating social policy to the king. In the context of, this is how you create merit. Yeah? So you need merit to advance spiritually. If to create merit, it isn't just sitting in your room and making mandala offerings, it's actively helping people. Yeah? Which I think is quite beautiful. And His Holiness Dalai Lama always, he praises the Christian monastics for getting out there and opening hospitals and schools and so on. So he really encourages us to do similar kinds of activities. So he continues, build pavilions in all towns, at temples and in all cities, along any thoroughfare where water is scarce, provide cisterns. Yeah. Out of your compassion, always care for the ill, the homeless, those afflicted by suffering, the downtrodden and unfortunate. Respectfully apply yourself to aiding them. Okay? So look out for your citizens and take care of them. And instead of blaming them for being sick or being homeless or whatever, have some compassion and teach them how to improve the conditions in their life. Yeah. Because so often, I don't know how it is here, but in my country, you know, so often, you know, because there's this thing of pull yourself up by your own bootstraps, then people who are suffering, who are downtrodden, some people look down upon them. You know, oh, you can't get your life together, so you're unemployed. But maybe it's, you know, for other reasons that they don't have a job. Yeah. Because they're, you know, they didn't get a good education. They didn't go to vocational school. Or, you know, there was illness in the family, or who knows what. So Nagarjuna is saying, really reach out to these people, yeah, who are downtrodden and help them. And he says, respectfully apply yourself to aiding them. So when we help other people, it's not a thing of looking down on them. Oh, you poor slob. You know, you can't get your life together. So you're homeless, you know, I'll get you someplace to live. Yeah. So it's not like that. It's, you know, respecting these people as human beings. And my experience in working with prison inmates is that respect means actually more to them than anything else. Yeah, because most of those people in their lives, their families have not been respected, or within the family, they, as an individual or as a child, have not been respected. And so just, you know, I go into prisons and I look people in the eye, I ask them questions, I, you know, if we have a group discussion, I get them involved. It's ordinary ways that you treat everybody. But for people in prison, it means the whole world because other people have not treated them that way. Yeah. And being in prison, you know, the guards are mean to you. Yeah, the courts don't help you. It's a very difficult. And so, you know, this thing of respect, and the respect comes because of genuine care and concern. And one thing I've really learned from working with inmates is that had I grown up in a different family, in a different environment, I probably would have acted like those people too. But I had the fortune of growing up with my mother and father, you know, and so I came out different. But, you know, I was sharing with somebody over lunch that One of the inmates I work with, he has 8 siblings. All of them have different fathers. Same mother, different fathers. He thought one particular man was his father. One day he overheard his mother talking to somebody else, and he found out that who he thought was his father was not his father. Okay? And then his mother was collecting income from the government for raising him after he had left home because he couldn't stand living there anymore. But he got none of the money, and she kept it for herself. Now imagine growing up in that kind of situation. How would you have turned out? Difficult. Difficult situation, isn't it? Especially if you're a kid and you just, you know? So, is compassion, you know, quite important. Compassion does not mean that you feel sorry for people. It does not mean that you baby them. Oh, you poor one. You didn't have this. You poor person. No, you teach them how to be responsible. Yeah, that's what respect is. Respect teaches people how to be responsible. It holds them accountable. So compassion is not a thing of making excuses for people. Yeah. It's really learning how to help them. Yeah?
You always say guys and he with the prisoners. Give the picture
to
you when you go to men?
Very few women contact us.
Oh, they contact you?
Yeah, we always wait for people to contact us. Very few women contact us. It's mostly men. And also, according to numbers in American prisons, the men vastly outnumber the women. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. At the cisterns, also place the 3 kinds of fruit, the 3 kinds of salt, honey, eye medicine, and antidotes to poison. Also write formulas for medicinal treatment and spells.
Wow.
So help the people who are traveling along your highways, you know, give them what they need. At these cisterns, also place ointments for the body, feet, and head, cradles so that the children have a place to sleep. Yeah, ladles and ewers so that when they cook food, they can serve it. Brass pots to cook their food in. Axes so that they can make the fire, and so on. Yeah, so be hospitable to these people who are traveling through your country. Beautiful, isn't it? In cool, shady spots, make small cisterns. We keep finding cisterns here, you know, because in India, in many areas, there's drought, and it's difficult to get water, or there's not any wells. So he's saying, really provide water for people. So in cool, shady spots, make small cisterns filled with potable water and provided with sesame, rice, grain, foods, and molasses. Wow. Now listen to this one. So it's not only the people you take care of. At the openings of anthills, have trustworthy persons constantly place food and water, molasses, and piles of grains, so that even your ants don't go hungry. Isn't that amazing? One of the nuns at the Abbey, because we live out in nature, so, you know, we live with all sorts of other critters. And we had some ants in the house. So she decided to feed the ants. She thought rather than have them walk all over the house, she would put the sugar and honey out in specific places on the counter for them. And after a while, we decided that was not a good policy. There was another way to feed the ants, okay? Because they also could have their dining room table outside, not inside, okay? Before and after each meal, always offer in a pleasant manner food to the hungry ghosts, dogs, ants, birds, and so forth. So don't just eat everything yourself. So at the Abbey, after our main meal, which is lunch, then we do an offering to the hungry ghosts. Yeah, and then, you know, we have some bread and we say a mantra and do the visualization and offer to them. And then we also, we share the land with turkeys and with deer and with all sorts of other living beings. So we try and feed them as we can, but we've learned to feed them away from the buildings where we live, especially in the autumn when the bear likes to, you know, eat well before he hibernates. Yeah, because bears will go right into your garbage, you know. They just open the lid and go right in. Raccoons, too. So you really have to feed them out in the forest. Always care extensively for places in the world that are oppressed or where crops have failed, that have suffered harm or where there is plague, or have been conquered in war. Provide seeds and foods to farmers who have fallen on hard times. Okay, so don't just care for your own country, yeah, but places in the world where people are oppressed. Yeah, my goodness, we read about Syria now, and Iraq, and so on. You know, help where we can. Help in places where crops have failed, Africa. You know, there's four countries facing severe famine there. Places that have suffered harm from war, places where there is plague. Remember when we had the Ebola epidemic? Help those people. And also places and people who have been conquered in war. Yeah, so have your compassion extend as far out as you can. And when farmers, you know, their crops have failed or they don't have money for equipment that they need to farm, give them seeds, provide the equipment that they need. Okay? Because these people are growing the food for the whole country. If you don't take care of the farmers, your whole populace is going to suffer. Okay, then more. Eliminate excessive taxes and reduce the portion of products taxed. But don't start a trade war, okay? Yeah, and don't, I mean, that's by increasing taxes and tariffs, isn't it, starting a trade war. But also, you know, you eliminate so many taxes that then the government doesn't have any money to spend to make the infrastructure or for education or healthcare. Yeah. But make practical tax systems whereby it's not that the poor get poorer and the rich get richer. Okay? So don't follow Trump's model. Okay? Because the tax thing they just passed in Congress is a disaster for middle-class families who were convinced that it was actually for their benefit. Protect citizens from debt. So maybe that means taking away their credit card. I don't know. Do people here suffer as much from credit card debt as they do in my country? Yeah.
Expensive loans.
Yeah, just going out. You know, I remember when I was little, if you wanted something, you had to do it on layaway. So you had to pay part of the money and save money and gradually pay it, and then you got it. Now you just go out, you put it on your credit card, with like a 14-15% interest, and then you go in credit card debt that just amplifies as time goes on, and it's really very harmful to people. Yeah, but the banks love it. Protect citizens from debt, eliminate new tolls, and reduce excessive tolls. So you need some tolls, but don't do excessive things. Eliminate the suffering of those who wait at your door with their petitions unanswered. So if you, you know, people have petitions they want the king and his bureaucracy to look at, you know, don't make these people wait months. Help them. So in our times, this would mean having an efficient bureaucracy. Wouldn't that be nice? Maybe you guys do. Now, our bureaucracy is very inefficient. You apply for something, they refer you somewhere else, they put you on a waiting list, you know, because there aren't enough employees, because there were tax cuts, and...
Come does it.
Huh?
Come to us in.
Yeah, you have that problem too? Yeah. So Nagarjuna is saying, no, people who need help, they should be able to be served quickly. Okay. Then eliminate bandits from your own land and in other lands as well. Keep prices level and place the proper value on goods. Okay, so reduce crime, especially people, in ancient times they had bandits because, you know, not all the land was claimed by somebody. There was a lot of open land that was unclaimed. And so if you traveled between point A and point B, and in the middle it didn't belong, the land didn't belong to anybody, you could be robbed by bandits. So he's saying, you know, protect people from bandits. Yeah, but don't kill them. Okay. And then keep your prices level. Don't let inflation, you know, take over things so that families can't afford stuff. And place the proper value on things. Don't be like some of the pharmaceutical companies that make very high prices on brand name drugs and then won't let you have a common label drug, you know? So we shouldn't exploit people by it when we set prices. I mean, I don't know how these people go to sleep at night, you know? Like setting unreasonable prices for medicine such that the people who need that medicine cannot afford it. Yeah, if you do that to enrich your own pocket, how can you sleep at night knowing that you're making people suffer? Yeah. Be thoroughly familiar with all that your advisors say and always do whatever is healthy for the world. So check up, you know, you have a bureaucracy, or, you know, you're the owner of a company, or you're the manager of a department. Check up on what the people under you are doing. You know, check up on what your advisors are saying, and listen to them, but listen with wisdom. Don't just believe them, ask questions, gain the information you need, and then make decisions based on what is healthy for the world. Yeah, don't make your decisions based on how you can get more money. Yeah, make decisions based on what is healthy for the world. Just as you pay attention to whatever you think will benefit you, so too pay attention to what you think will benefit others. Yeah? So he's telling the king, he's telling business people, he's telling all of us, yeah? Don't just pay attention to what helps us. Think about what helps everybody in the situation. Yeah.
You ask, you say you don't know what it is in our country. Actually, a lot of what Nagarjuna wrote for those many years we had in this country, but over the last 20 years or so, it's slowly being destroyed.
Really?
Yeah. And right now, we are at the brink of people are demonstrating because there are they're trying to reduce the teachers' time to
prepare
for teaching the children at school, uh-huh. and cut down on people's eating lunch hours and so on. Mm-hmm. But the trade unions are standing shoulder with shoulder in a musketeer oath to keep those things. Mm. So maybe it's turning now.
Yeah.
That's the political situation in Denmark right now.
And this is the thing where we really need to stand up for really what's the good of the country and the citizens. Yeah. It's a beautiful verse, isn't it? Just as you pay attention to whatever you think will benefit you, so too pay attention to what you think will benefit others. Yeah.
I think it is difficult sometimes in the helping professions to find that balance. Mm-hmm. For instance, people that are offering very much to people that are in war or traumatized, they themselves get traumatized.
Yeah.
Or suffer from compassion fatigue, mm-hmm. or things like that.
Yeah.
So I think they need a practice also.
Definitely. And so he's not saying here, help others so much that you collapse and so that you can't help anybody. I don't recall reading the verse that says that, you know? So it's the thing of helping what we can, but it's very important that we keep ourselves balanced. Yeah? And to know what we can do and what we cannot do. And even though we would like to be able to do more, to be able to say sometimes, I would like to do more, but I'm unable. Please excuse me. Yeah. And because it's really very important to keep ourselves balanced. Otherwise, other people have to take care of us. Yeah. And so, you know, this is something often that happens. People get, and there could be all sorts of different things going on mentally or psychologically, but we get so engrossed in helping others that we forget about ourselves or we neglect our own family, and then problems arise. So, you know, helping others doesn't mean sacrificing ourselves. Yeah? It means being practical, having our feet on the ground, yeah? Knowing when we can do something, knowing when we can't do something. Yeah. So this whole thing, because very often we get ourselves in situations where we say, I should do that. I ought to do that. People are expecting me to do this. I'm supposed to fulfill that. And especially this happens to women, you know, because we are acculturated to take care of everybody. Yeah? And as a result, we often lose ourselves or neglect to take care of what's actually important. Yeah? Because we become people pleasers running around fixing everybody else's problems, even if they don't want their problems fixed. Yeah, but we feel it's our job. And then as a result, we get exhausted and can't function very well. Yeah. And then we feel guilty if we have to say, I'm sorry, I'm not able to do that. But there's no reason to feel guilty if we look at our situation and we're not saying no out of laziness or lack of care. We're saying no because it just isn't practical. You know, I can't do everything. And I have to realize that. So actually, I think it's very important, because some of us tend to, whenever somebody asks for help, we say yes. Yeah. And then we get ourselves so overcommitted that we can't do it. And it's embarrassing to go to the person that we said yes to and say, I haven't done it, or I can't do it. So we just keep quiet because we don't want to be embarrassed. But the other person is still counting on us. And the day arrives when they need what we said we would do, and we're nowhere around, and we never told them before that we couldn't do it, so they never had the opportunity to, you know, arrange alternative help. Yeah. So that's not so good. Yeah. It's much better when somebody asks for help right at the beginning to check, can I do that or can't I? You know, do I have the skills? Do I have the time? You know, are the conditions that I'd be working in such that I can complete the task? And if we can't do it, tell the person right away so they can ask for other volunteers or other people to help. Or if we say yes, because we can do it, and then, as they say, life happens, and, you know, we get sick or some other obstacle arises, and we can't complete what we said, then go to the person immediately and say, I'm sorry, I can't do what I told you I was going to do because unforeseen circumstances arose. So please excuse me. And then if you can find a substitute, do that. If you can't, at least give the other person enough notice. Don't cancel at the last minute. Yeah. So especially if you're volunteering to do things. Yeah. At Dharma centers and monasteries, we work a lot with volunteers. We know what it's like. And people want to help. They say yes with a good heart. But they're not practical. And then it becomes kind of a mess for us. Yeah. So don't feel bad when you have to say no because it's just something you can't do. Yeah. It's okay. Okay. Next verse. Like the earth, water, fire, and wind, wild herbs and the plants of the forest, make yourself and your possessions available for the general enjoyment of all. So this is for collecting merit and wisdom. So just as the four elements, earth, water, fire, air, and just as, you know, in ancient times, the wild herbs in the forest that, you know, that aren't owned by anybody. So just as there were all these things that weren't owned and, you know, people could come and take what they need, so too, out of compassion, you know, make ourselves and our possessions available to all. That doesn't mean that you put everything you own on your front porch and say, come and get it, okay? But that means to have a generous attitude, yeah? So that when people need help, we help them in the same way that we would help ourselves if that were us. Even when taking their seventh step, bodhisattvas have the attitude of giving away all their possessions. This produces merit in them that is as limitless as the sky itself. So it says that when bodhisattvas are on the final lifetime, after they're born, they take seven steps. Remember the story of the Buddha's life? After he was born, he took seven steps, and then he said, "This is my last lifetime." Yeah. So that it's talking about that all the bodhisattvas doing that. And they have an attitude of giving away all their possessions. And because they have that attitude, you know, whether they give things away or not, because of that generous attitude, not clinging and feeling possessive of stuff, then they accumulate masses of merit. Okay? So what this is saying for us is let's subdue this mind that is possessive of things. Yeah, this is my phone. This is my child. This is my house. This is my, you know, clock, whatever it is. So to loosen up that possessiveness and realize that things do not inherently belong to us. They are not inherently ours. Everything we have was given to us by somebody else. Even if we paid for it, somebody gave it to us. And who gave us the money to pay for it? Somebody gave us the money, even if we worked for them. Okay? So the idea is, you know, things are not mine like this. Yeah. So just kind of chill out a bit. And, especially if you have plenty, then think of how you can use what you have to benefit other living beings. Because that way, you know, you create so much merit. And so then he goes on. We're not at that section yet. We're at a very interesting section. But after some verses, he goes on to tell the king, you know, you have all this wealth now. Give it away to create merit. Because when you're on your deathbed, you're not going to be able to give it away. And after you die, it's no longer yours. So if you want to create merit, use your wealth to create merit now, because you may not have a chance to do that later. But that's coming in a few verses. Okay. Now, this is a very interesting section, 259. Okay, so get ready. If you bestow well-adorned, beautiful maidens upon those who seek them, you will thereby attain the dharanis that hold the holy dharma. Previously, the victor, the Buddha, bestowed 80,000 maidens adorned with all kinds of ornaments, accompanied by all kinds of goods. So this sounds like you're trafficking in human beings, doesn't it? Yeah? It sounds like you're trafficking in sex slaves, giving these maidens away. Yeah? And we go, okay. But, okay, first of all, we have to see ancient Indian culture. Yeah? He's, the king is probably responsible because in ancient India, there were no love marriages. Yeah, all the marriages were arranged. So if the family didn't arrange them, then probably the king had the responsibility to arrange the marriages. And if you weren't married, it was bad news. You were ostracized, basically. Okay? So the king was given these young girls, and it was his responsibility to marry them off. Okay? So he made them well adorned. He gave them ornaments. He gave them dowries, because in ancient India, actually in modern India too, you know, a woman has to come with a dowry. So he made sure that these women were properly married so that they weren't outcasts in their community, that they brought a dowry, and that they were properly adorned and made to look beautiful, because that is what the man wanted. So this was the custom of ancient India. Thank goodness it's not our custom now. Okay. But people read these verses, and sometimes people go ballistic, you know. And also, sometimes we read other verses or stories, like in the Jataka tales, there's many stories about how the Buddha, as a bodhisattva, he gave away his wife and children. Yeah, sometimes even to spirits and demons. Yeah, because they asked for them. And we read these stories. Give away your wife and kids? No way, you know. It's like you don't own them. They're free individuals. They aren't your property. You can't give them away. But in ancient India, they were the man's property. Yeah, women had very little freedom then. They were first the property of their fathers, then their husbands, then their sons. Okay? So, these stories that we hear that sound to us like being completely insensitive to your family and being human trafficking, you know, and creating slaves out of people. In ancient times, this was accepted. And the reason that these stories are told, like giving away your wife and your kids. They never talk about giving away your husband and kids. Yeah, because the women didn't have the power to do that. But the point of those stories was, this is the level of non-attachment that a bodhisattva have. Because most men were so attached to their wife and their kids, they didn't want to let anybody else look at their wife. Okay? So, but here there's the example of the bodhisattva who is not attached to them, who is willing to give them away. So that's the point of these stories, of not being attached to family members. Because most people are very attached to family members. But the point of the story is not that you own human beings and it's your prerogative to give them away, and that it's okay to, you know, get involved in human trafficking. That's not the point of the stories. Okay, so that makes some sense to you? Okay. Yeah, because sometimes I've been in teachings, the Tibetan lamas teach this. They don't think of the cultural difference between then and now. They just read the verse and teach it. And Westerners are in the audience and we're going, you know, why are you extolling this? This is horrible. Yeah. And but the Tibetan Lamas never think, I mean, they don't have the same cultural values we do. So, you know, they just take it, oh yeah, this is illustrating generosity. Yeah? And we take it like this is illustrating cruelty. Yeah? And it's illegal. And it needs to be stopped. Yeah. Okay? So, there, you know, there's certain, we have to be aware of cultural differences.
I think there's still still in some circles, people think like that.
Mm, yeah.
And kill the woman if she wants to to something else that her parents did.
That's true. Yeah, in many countries. Yeah,
also in Denmark, in some circles, parents.
And I know in Thailand and some other places, people, you know, they have a daughter, they can't, they're poor, they give their daughter to a pimp because they can't support her, and so she goes to the city as a prostitute. Yeah, unbelievable, isn't it? But this is sometimes what poverty does to families. Okay. So we're not going to end on that. We're going to have a better verse to end on, okay? Okay. To those who come begging, lovingly give numerous and resplendent clothes, ornaments, perfumes, and garlands, and other objects of enjoyment. So for those who come begging, who ask for things, give them. If you have those things, give it. 262, there is no greater act of generosity than to grant to the extremely unfortunate who are bereft of some aspect of the Dharma the happy chance to receive the teachings on it. So give the Dharma. Now, when people need the Dharma, they don't have it, share the teachings with them. Okay. Now there's many ways to do that. You don't have to say, oh, you have a problem. Let me take out what Chandrakirti says and verse 104, lines A and B say blah, blah, and lines C and D say blah, blah. But no, you don't have to do that. There's so much of Buddhism that is just common sense. And when your friends need help, you can teach them Buddhist methods for how to work with their mind. And express it just in common, simple language. You know, you don't have to talk about Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, Nirvana, Karma, you know, these samsara. Yeah, you just talk simple language, but you explain how to remedy anger. Yeah, how to, remedy attachment. Or another thing that is very good for your friends or family members, leave a Dharma book around the house. Yeah? Just leave it around the house. You forgot to put it away. Just leave it there. Yeah. I had a friend whose sister was a Jehovah's Witness. And you know those people are quite strict. And she left a Dharma book around her house. Her sister picked it up. And then her sister said to her, you know, some of the things that you believe are things that we also believe. Yeah? Wow. Okay. Another way to help your family and your friends that I tell people, especially young people, you know, they just have a Dharma course. You want your friends and your family to get interested in Dharma. I tell them, go home and take out the garbage. Yeah? Because your parents will kind of stop and go, you know, for 40 years I've been asking my son to take out the garbage. And he goes to one Buddhist course and he comes home and he does it. Wow, I like Buddhism, says Mom. Okay? So, you know, just these simple things that you show through the change in your behavior, then it makes other people interested. I had one friend and she had red hair, she had lupus, so she was in a wheelchair. They used to call her Hellfire on Wheels. Okay? And was indicative of her personality, you know, too. And she came and she started studying the Dharma, yeah. And she got, this was like many years ago, so when, before they had iPads and iPods and podcasts, so she got all the tapes, the cassette tapes of the Dharma, of the Lamrim. There were like over 100 or over 200 of them. She got all of them. And, you know, and she was practicing, and it changed her behavior such that one of her colleagues came into her office and one day said, "What have you been doing? Because you're different than how you used to be." And then she said, "Well, I've been going to these Buddhist classes." And then she loaned her tapes to her colleague, who then became very interested in the Dharma. So there's, you know, all sorts of ways to share the Dharma without pushing it on people, without proselytizing. Okay? So I think that's a good place to end. Yeah? Okay, so we weren't able to finish the chapter. In Tibetan culture, if you always leave something unfinished, because it means you have to meet again to finish it. So even if the teacher finishes the whole text, they go back to the beginning and read the first few verses as if they're teaching it again and then leaving the rest unfinished.
So why are you doing next weekend?
Next weekend, I'm going to be outside Hamburg, and you can all come to the retreat there. It starts Thursday evening and goes to Sunday. You're very welcome to come. Okay?
Okay, Kate Beckett.
No, you asked a question. I told you. And instead of expecting me to come to you, you have to exert some energy and come to me. Okay?
I got it.
Good, I'll see you next weekend. Venerable Jampa can give you all the details.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's sit quietly and just rejoice at what we've done. And rejoice at the merit we've created and what all of us have done together as a group and all of our merit. And while we're rejoicing, rejoice at all the merit that all sentient beings have created and that all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas have created. And send that merit out to all the living beings and think that it makes their minds peaceful and that it gives them whatever it is they need. Physically, mentally, spiritually.